Morgan Chase and its CEO, Jamie Dimon, for billions of dollars.
Trump claims that his accounts were unfairly closed after the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol.
We'll have more on that lawsuit this Thursday, January 22nd, on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. How historical preservation and marketing come into conflict along West Africa's slave coast.
It's very commodified. Disney World, there's no dignity and humanity in the project.
Also, much of the central and southeast U.S. is getting ready for a massive winter storm.
A lot of salt and a lot of shovels, for sure. Gloves, hats, all the hand warmers, I'm almost sold out of those earlier.
And our movie critic Bob Mondello on what surprised him in this year's Oscar nominations.
Those stories and so much more after this summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. Desperate Palestinians are burning trash to keep warm in Gaza after 2 years of the Israel-Hamas war. Meanwhile, in Davos, Switzerland, President Trump inaugurated his Board of Peace to oversee reconstruction of the enclave. Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, says the next phase of the ceasefire deal will address disarming Hamas and rebuilding Gaza.
Gaza, as President Trump's been saying, has amazing potential, and this is for the people of Gaza. We've developed it into zones. In the beginning, we were toying with the idea of saying, let's build a free zone, and then we have a Hamas zone. And then we said, you know what, let's just plan for catastrophic success. Hamas signed a deal to demilitarize. That is what we are going to enforce. People ask us what our plan B is. We do not have a plan B.
President Trump's ambitions for the Board of Peace have grown. He says it could rival the United Nations' role in resolving international conflicts, but many U.S. allies have opted not to participate so far. Trump has said he's not sure if he would chair the group after his term in office. A new study says the U.S. homicide rate has fallen to a historic low. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports it marks what researchers are calling a dramatic turnaround in violent crime.
The national homicide rate is on track to reach its lowest level in 125 years and the steepest single-year drop on record. That's according to the Council on Criminal Justice, which analyzed crime data from 40 major U.S. cities. The report found 25% fewer homicides, 13% fewer shootings, and a nearly 30% drop in carjackings compared to 2019, all now below pre-pandemic levels. The FBI hasn't released full national data yet, but local trends suggest the pandemic crime spike was a blip, not a lasting trend. Drug crimes were the only category that ticked up last year, but they remain lower than before the pandemic. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
The Supreme Court has received an emergency request from California's Republican Party to block the state's new Democratic-leaning congressional map. As NPR's Hansi Lo Wong reports, the map is California Democrats' counter to the nationwide gerrymandering push led by President Trump and his Republican allies.
A panel of three federal judges recently rejected a challenge to the congressional voting map by California's GOP and the Trump administration. The Republicans claimed that race and not partisan politics was the main driver of the map's redrawing. That new map could help Democrats pick up 5 more U.S. House seats in this year's midterm election. California voters approved the new districts last year to offset the new Texas map that President Trump pushed for to help Republicans. Last month, the Supreme Court decided to allow Texas to use it for the midterms. The High Court has previously ruled that partisan gerrymandering is not reviewable by federal courts, but California Republicans hope the race argument is a way to get their challenge heard. In the meantime, New York and Virginia are also taking steps to redistrict in a way that will likely favor Democrats. Hansi Lo Wong, NPR News.
U.S. stocks rose today and regained more of their losses for the week. This is NPR News from Washington. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is criticizing Europeans for their slow response to Russia's invasion. Meanwhile, he says talks with President Trump have been productive at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. He's urging Europe to become a global force, contrasting its response to Washington's actions in Venezuela and Iran. The Trump administration says the U.S. has completed its withdrawal from the World Health Organization. As NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports, the WHO says the U.S. actually has to pay its bills first.
Just over 1 year ago, President Trump announced his intention to leave the World Health Organization, accusing the agency of mismanaging the COVID-19 pandemic. The U.S. has to give 1 year's notice to withdraw, according to a decades-old congressional resolution. That same resolution also stipulates that the U.S. can only leave if it's paid all its outstanding dues, and it currently owes over $250 million. The U.S. won't be paying that, the State Department told NPR, but says it's still out of the WHO. The exit has cut millions from WHO's budget and forced layoffs at the agency. The withdrawal could also mean that the U.S. loses access to key health and disease data that influences everything from designing annual flu shots to detecting the virus that could spark the next pandemic. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Texas has become the top source of new residents for 9 other states, despite its own population growth. The Census Bureau released figures showing Texas is the leading source of residents moving to states like Alaska, California, and Oklahoma. Meanwhile, Texas gained 2.1 million people between 2020 and 2024, with 31 million residents. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
It is 5:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Support for KAXE comes from Ledger & Ladle, a restaurant in downtown Grand Rapids with a rotating menu every few months to explore a new region, technique, or ingredient. Open Wednesday through Friday, 3 to 9 p.m., Saturdays, 5 to 9, and Sundays, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. More at ledgerandladle.com. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump has sued the country's largest bank, J.P. Morgan Chase, and its chief executive, Jamie Dimon. Trump is demanding at least $5 billion in damages over allegations that the bank unfairly closed his accounts for political reasons. NPR financial correspondent Maria Aspin joins us now with more. Hi, Maria.
Hey, Elsa.
Hey. Okay, so I realize that President Trump has been coming at banks for like years now over this issue of politically motivated debanking. But this lawsuit, it feels like quite a personal escalation, right? Like, tell us more about what happened here.
So President Trump's attorney filed this lawsuit in Miami-Dade County State Court today. And as you noted, the reasons go back at least 5 years to the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol, which were carried out by supporters of President Trump as he was on his way out of office.
Mm-hmm.
Trump claims in his lawsuit that weeks later, J.P. Morgan Chase closed his accounts for what the suit calls, quote, political and social motivations, and its desire to distance itself from Trump's conservative political views. So effectively, Trump is alleging he was debanked. And as you pointed out, this has been a big and long-standing criticism of big banks by the president and by other conservatives who believe that they've been locked out of the mainstream banking system because of their political beliefs.
Okay, and what does J.P. Morgan Chase say about these allegations?
It says the suit is without merit. In an emailed statement, a spokesperson told me that it, quote, does not close accounts for political or religious reasons. We do close accounts because they create legal or regulatory risk for the company, which is important. Banks in general can be in between a rock and a hard place when it comes to government rules, because regulators tend to hold banks responsible for the activities of their clients. So banks tend to be pretty cautious of who they provide services to. J.P. Morgan Chase, in fact, said today that it's been asking the administration to change the regulations that put it into this position. But I have to say, it was not surprised by the lawsuit, because Trump posted on Truth Social over the weekend that he was going to sue J.P. Morgan Chase. And there's also been more going on between the president and the bank beyond just this.
Oh, really? Like what? Like, what exactly is behind these debanking criticisms?
Well, on debanking, Trump has spent the past year attacking banks over what he calls their unwillingness to do business with him and with conservatives more generally. In August, he specifically called out J.P. Morgan and Bank of America in this interview with CNBC.
So I went to another one. I ended up going to small banks all over the place. I mean, I was putting $10 million here, $10 million there.
A few days later, Trump issued an executive order targeting what he called politicized or unlawful debanking. And he's also separately sued Capital One over similar allegations.
But I also understand, Maria, that the president is upset with J.P. Morgan Chase beyond these debanking allegations, right?
Yeah, it's the biggest bank in the country, and Jamie Dimon is one of the most powerful and relatively outspoken CEOs in the country. Now, Dimon has generally been good at threading the needle of pushing back against some of Trump's policies, like his tariffs, while still having his ear. But in the last few weeks, he's poked the bear a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Dimon has stood up for an independent Federal Reserve at a time that Trump has been trying to exert more control over it, and he had some pretty harsh words for President Trump's proposed cap on credit card interest rates. Dimon called it an economic disaster on stage at Davos. So a few hours later, Trump filed this lawsuit. It's fair to say things between the president and the country's biggest bank are pretty tense right now.
Yes, to say the least. That is NPR's Maria Aspin. Thank you, Maria.
Thank you.
Much of the central and southeast United States is bracing for what could become a historic winter storm starting tomorrow. Justin Hicks from the Appalachia Mid-South Newsroom reports people in Kentucky are preparing now since their state lies directly in the path of the storm.
Keith's Hardware Store in Louisville, Kentucky is busy. Store manager Emily Martin says everyone coming in wants the same things.
A lot of salt and a lot of shovels, for sure. Gloves, hats, all the hand warmers. I almost sold out of those earlier. It seemed like today was like, all right, everyone's like, let me go get all of my stuff.
Nancy Carter was one of the customers, racing in after work to buy pet-safe salt and sand to keep in her car to help with traction in the upcoming snow. Forecasts over the past few days have ranged from just a few inches to more than a foot.
Somebody told me 10 inches. If it could be, then you must be prepared.
Carter is one of many bracing for a huge winter storm that's expected to blanket states from Texas to Maryland in snow. Points further south could see dangerous ice and freezing rain. National Weather Service meteorologist Samantha Wilson says part of what makes this storm so significant is that it could linger over some areas.
So it's a long event. We're talking maybe close to 48 hours of snowfall. And as the system kind of wavers and moves across the area, that snow may change over to ice or freezing rain.
Wilson says snow is preferable to ice, but in some areas, the sheer amount of snow could still overwhelm infrastructure and weigh down trees near roads and power lines. And below freezing temperatures could stick around for a while.
And this will definitely bring an impact to our road systems, our utility systems, and just general daily life. So preparing for this storm is imperative.
In many places, state and local emergency management crews are doing just that. Governors in many states have already issued states of emergency ahead of the storm to get resources in place. Kentucky's Emergency Management Director, Eric Gibson, says road crews and the National Guard are on standby to help clear driving paths, forestry teams are ready to cut tree limbs, and state parks are making arrangements to provide warm shelter.
We work hard to stay in front of those things, so we're quick to respond when there is an issue.
Gibson says people can help by stocking up on food, medicine, and fuel now, while the skies are clear. For NPR News, I'm Justin Hicks in Louisville, Kentucky.
More than 12 million Africans were enslaved during the transatlantic slave trade. Over the centuries, most were taken to the Americas, while millions of others died along the way. Today, monuments to this brutal history still stand along the coast of West Africa. But as NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu reports in the fourth installment of our series along a rapidly developing West African coastline, some fear that preservation and commercialization are increasingly in conflict.
The Atlantic waves crash at the foot of the towering white walls of Elmina Castle, Ghana. It's one of several slave forts dotted along the coast in West and Central Africa. Inside, a tour guide leads a group of 20 people.
And about 150 female enslaved Africans were shared in this dungeon, or were kept here.
His voice echoes across the cobbled courtyard and in the surrounding dungeons where enslaved people were kept and tortured.
The materials we see here were all brought by people who visited the castle to pay homage to their ancestors.
Inside the cells, flowers have been laid to rest on the ground, once coated in layers of excrement and blood, which has slowly softened it over time. For decades, these monuments have drawn a growing number of visitors from the African diaspora connecting to their histories.
So please, before we leave here, if you want to pray to the ancestors, say anything, or even take a picture, have a look at this place. You can do that before we see the next place.
But in recent years, interest in the legacy of slavery has surged. Ghana's 2019 year of return brought over 1 million mostly black diaspora visitors, generating billions of dollars, according to the government. Its success has spurred other West African countries to explore the economic potential of these historic sites. All along the coastline from Nigeria to Ivory Coast, government projects to develop these monuments are rapidly taking shape. And of all of them, the most expansive and ambitious plans are in the historic city of Ouidah, Benin, where the government is building La Marina. Slick video adverts show digital projections of what will become a vast tourism and memorial complex, complete with luxury hotels, pools, and spas, and a performance arena for Vodou, the indigenous religion in Benin. And at its heart is a life-size replica of a slave ship. It's all been built with investments, including from China, and constructed by China's state-owned construction company.
Actuellement, le gouvernement...
The government is currently investing heavily in tourism. So there are a lot of renovations, which means that when people come, they want to come back.
Odrio Gomez is a tour guide in Ouidah. He's a descendant of formerly enslaved people who returned from Brazil and serves on a local committee advising the government. He welcomes the new development and describes how the site is being reconfigured. Workers are paving parts of the grounds around the Tree of Oblivion, where enslaved people were made to forget their identities, where the plaques and monuments are being restored or even replaced. And a new gate will mark a fresh point of no return on the Atlantic shore, replacing the current beachfront archway. But the development has not been welcomed by everyone.
It's very commodified, Disney World, there's no dignity and humanity in the project.
Dr. Dominique Somda is an anthropologist at Kalamazoo College in Michigan. She was raised in Benin and has spent years studying African slave forts. She said tourism in countries like Benin, where they're making a concerted push to attract visitors, has a complicated legacy.
It will be very interesting to see in the future how tourists are actually responding to those new infrastructures, right? Is that what they are actually looking for? Are they looking for example, a replica of slave ships?
All along our 600-mile journey from Nigeria to Ivory Coast, former slave forts have formed a string of historical touchpoints for visitors exploring the legacy of the transatlantic slave trade. But in places like Benin, some are asking whether the balance between preservation and profit is tilting. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Benin.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
This is The Setlist on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at four shows Thursday through Saturday, January 22nd through the 24th in Brainerd, Virginia, Bemidji, and Hackensack. First up, The Smoking Desk will be at the Blue Oyster in Brainerd, 7 p.m. on Thursday. The group are a six-piece band from the Brainerd Lakes area who draw from the improvisational spirit of jazz, the grittiness of the blues, and the intricate harmonies of bluegrass. It's The Smoking Desk this Thursday at the Blue Oyster in Brainerd. On to Friday for Iroma Palooza at the Mako Theater in downtown Virginia at 6 p.m. The historic Art Deco Theater has been restored in the last couple of years and will host music from Rich Matson and the North Stars, Owler, Thor Leisman and the Radical Pulse, Wild Child, Josh Palmy and Trapper, Midnight Kiss Fight, and Dave Rave and the Governors. It is Iroma Palooza this Friday at the Mako Theater in Virginia. Bemidji Brewing is continuing their Timber Tap sessions with Bumps on a Log this Saturday. The group are a jam funk trio featuring members of Forge North. Timber Tap sessions take place every other Saturday through April at 5 p.m. at the brewery. Finally, Americana and folk singer Charlie Wagner continues his Finding Home music and book tour this Saturday at Rendezvous Brewing in Hackensack. He released an accompanying book with his 2025 album, Finding Home, and will be sharing stories from the book along with his music. this Saturday, 6 p.m. at Rendezvous Brewing. If you have information on live music you'd like us to know about, email comments at kaxc.org. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. If you or someone you know is living with Parkinson's disease, there is a support group the first Tuesday of every month at 1 p.m. in the meeting room at Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids. The Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness Quota Permit will be available beginning at 9 a.m. Wednesday, January 28th for the 2026 season. Book reservations online at recreation.gov/BWCAW or call 877-444-6777. Visitors are encouraged to review the trip planning guide and do your homework for the more than 265 backcountry campsites. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. If you provide childcare for a friend or family member, there are educational resources and supplies available through the Indigenous nonprofit All Nations Rise. Items include books, trainings, first aid kits, and more. Learn more at allnationsrise.com/FFM. iLink Minnesota helps those with vision loss move forward with technology-based solutions. Your donation can bring hope and independence. Learn more by searching for iLink Minnesota online. That's the word I, spelled E-Y-E. The 20th Annual Back to Basics Sustainable Living Event is Saturday, February 7th at Pine River Backus School. The morning keynote and vendor fair are free and require no registration. But if you'd like to participate in workshops, register and find more info at happydancingturtle.org. The Winter Lecture Series continues at the Forest History Center in Grand Rapids, Saturday, January 17th at 1 p.m. Author Pete Caro will talk about innovations in mine land management that have led to ecological restoration.
There's the studio that Netflix and Paramount are fighting over.
Right.
They're big budget, big swings that don't get made much anymore. Also fueled by politics are the Brazilian film The Secret Agent, set during that country's 1970s dictatorship, and Begonia, a social satire about conspiracy theorists who kidnap a big pharma exec convinced she's a space alien.
Like what?
Very odd picture, yes.
Okay, what about the other films, which were more like character studies, right? Like movies such as Marty Supreme, which came with so much hype before it was released.
This is true. Marty Supreme is about a 1950s ping pong hustler played by Timothy Chalamet. Frankenstein, Guillermo del Toro's sensual take on the sensitive monster classic. Mm-hmm. Also Sentimental Value, a family drama about two daughters and their neglectful filmmaking father. That's from Norway. Hamnet, about the death of Shakespeare's son, a mother's grief and history's most famous play. Train Dreams, the story of a lumberjack set in the Pacific Northwest in the age of steam locomotives, and F1, about Formula One race car drivers played by Brad Pitt and Damson Idris.
Were there any nominations that surprised even you, Bob?
Well, F1's nomination for Best Picture does surprise me, I have to say. But no, I'm always a little skeptical of the idea of snubs. There are 5 slots for every category but Best Picture with 10, and there are lots of terrific artists working in movies, so you do the math. There's something's going to get left out. That said, I imagine the folks involved in Wicked, for good, are feeling left out of this party.
Yeah.
Last year, the first Wicked got 10 nominations, including one for Best Picture. This one got none.
Yeah, I mean, the silence was deafening.
Yes. There were some pleasant surprises, though. Kate Hudson for Best Actress in Song Sung Blue. She's easily the best thing about that movie. Ditto Delroy Lindo in Sinners. He's always great, and he's kind of a linchpin to the plot there. And as I say, the folks who made F1 have to be pleasantly surprised.
Brad Pitt does it again. Okay, so there is a new category this year, Best Casting. Let's talk about that category.
Well, I know what it ought to be about. Casting can make or break a movie, and some films make a huge virtue of thinking outside the box. The French film Serrat, set at a rave concert in the Sahara, was cast almost entirely with non-actors, and it's riveting. But it wasn't nominated. The nominees are all front-runners for Best Picture. Mm-hmm. No argument there. It makes sense that the best films of the year would be the best cast films, but from an Oscar-viewing standpoint, it doesn't seem like a very thrilling way to start a new category.
Yeah, I agree. That was NPR's Bob Mondello. Thank you so much, Bob.
It's always a pleasure.
Okay, question. When was the last time you wrote someone a letter? Like a real letter, an actual letter, pen to paper, licking the envelope, slipping it into a mailbox. Well, a novel from last year is inspiring people to do just that. Here to tell us more is NPR's book correspondent, Andrew Limbong. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Tell us about the novel.
All right. It's called The Correspondent. It's by Virginia Evans. I think it's fair to call this the sleeper hit of 2025. Evans is a debut novelist, and this book is about a woman in her 70s named Sybil. And you learn about her through the letters she writes. It's an epistolary novel, right? And so she's writing to her friends, to her kids, to people from her past, to complete strangers, and, you know, famous writers she admires. And you get this, like, rich description of a person. You read the book, right?
I have indeed.
What'd you think of Sybil?
I loved her. She's cranky. She's a little uptight. But who amongst us isn't occasionally cranky and a little uptight? I think I loved her because, as you said, she's in her 70s. She's divorced. She's retired. She's the kind of person you might write off as like, the biggest adventures in life are behind her. Mm-hmm. And she so proves you wrong, and you're totally rooting for her.
Yeah.
Okay, so you wrote about her. I know you did a little bit of a shout-out for NPR Books newsletter.
Yeah.
A lot of other people liked it and are loving this book, too.
Yeah, I was trying to really figure out why this book was such a hit. What made the book tick? And I was, you know, writing to the newsletter readers, and I just got this deluge of emails back being like, oh, I loved it. You know, I read it in book club and everybody there loved it. I read
it in book club and most of us loved it.
Yeah.
Go on.
But an interesting trend I found from the responses were people who were saying, this book influenced me to start writing letters myself. This book got me to, like, you know, they were reading the letters that Sybil was writing, and they're like, I want to do just that. I want to shout out one person who wrote in. Her name is Carly Bassett. She's a therapist based out of Austin. She finished The Correspondent on New Year's Eve. And at first, she was just inspired to take on a personal challenge to write 26 letters in 2026, right? But then she wanted to connect with people and share in this experience of writing letters. So she started a group to do just that. It's called The Correspondence Course, and they just had their first meeting last week.
We were able to just have this really cool conversation around the nostalgia of letter writing and the memories and that connection to childhood and grandparents and past lovers and pen pals. And there was just something childlike about kind of seeing that excitement.
She told me that a big part of their discussion was getting over some of the barriers to letter writing, right? And, you know, she's a therapist, and I thought the barriers she was getting at were like, oh, it's hard to be vulnerable writing a letter. It's hard to figure out what to write about. But here's what she told me.
The most interesting barrier, and I've seen this in my work with clients and young people don't know where to get stamps.
Okay. The post office people. You can do this. Yeah. Or online, like everything online. Else.
Also, 78 cents a pop now these days. I was like, okay. All right.
Fair.
It's a little.
Fair. Okay. Do we know how many people are following Carly's leads? How many people might be taking inspiration writing?
Yeah. I mean, that's hard to say. Anecdotally, I've heard word on the street is that the stationery section at bookstores has been getting a lot more traction than usual. But, you know, listen, according to Circana BookScan, this book has sold nearly 300,000 print copies.
That's
so we're not talking audiobook, we're not talking ebook, we're not talking library loans. And so if even just a portion of the people who have read this book start picking up a pen and writing a letter, that's a decent bump.
I am heading to order stationery even as we speak. Andrew Limbong, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Mary Louise.
The book is The Correspondent, and you can find the NPR Books newsletter that he mentioned at npr.org/newsletter/books.
This is NPR News.
It is 5:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Extreme cold warning and watch from today throughout the weekend with wind chill from 40 to 55 below zero. The dangerously cold wind chills could cause frostbite on exposed skin in as little as 5 minutes. And Ski Palooza at Three Island Park in Bemidji has been postponed due to the cold temps this weekend. Stay tuned for a new date.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report.
U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar has filed paperwork for her campaign for Minnesota governor Thursday. The move comes weeks after Governor Tim Walz ended his campaign for a third term amid a widening scandal of fraud in state-run social service programs. A person close to the senator tells the Minnesota Reformer it's a preliminary step for any candidate considering a run, and that Klobuchar will make an announcement of her plans in the coming days. 65-year-old Klobuchar has been reelected resoundingly three times since first winning her seat in 2006. In recent weeks, Klobuchar has been an opponent of the federal immigration surge in Minnesota. She typically focuses on broadly popular, often bipartisan legislation, like funding rural broadband infrastructure, banning lead in children's products, and expanding services for victims of human trafficking. The U.S. House of Representatives passed a joint resolution to repeal a 20-year mining ban on Superior National Forest lands near the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. 8th Congressional District Republican Congressman Pete Stauber, who represents the area, introduced the joint resolution. It nullifies a public land order from 2023 by the Biden administration, which withdrew more than 225,000 acres of national forest lands from mineral and geothermal leasing. The Trump administration says Biden failed to notify Congress of the order and itself provided notice earlier this month. During the floor debate on Wednesday, Stauber described the ban as dangerous and illegal in an area of strategic importance for mining critical minerals like copper, nickel, and cobalt.
This PLO sacrificed thousands of good-paying union jobs that would support families for generations, along with billions of dollars of revenue for our schools and state and federal governments.
Democratic Congresswoman Betty McCollum of Minnesota's 4th District spoke against the measure. She also disagreed that it was illegal, saying Congress was notified at the time of the ban.
The BWCA is a huge reserve of the most pristine water in the United States, so clean you can directly drink from its lakes or streams. And this water is under threat once again.
Stauber emphasized the measure doesn't authorize any mining projects and that mining would not happen within the Boundary Waters area or established buffers, although the area in question is located within the same Rainy River watershed. It must now be passed by the Senate before it can go to the president's desk. The Nisswa City Council made moves to censure its mayor and remove her committee assignments at its meeting Tuesday. Larissa Donovan has the update on the former chair of the Minnesota Republican Party.
Mayor Jennifer Carnahan made the motion to adopt what she called a hollow resolution.
Using public funds and resources to formalize personal dissatisfaction without substance or authority serves no legitimate purpose for the city. All this document does is basically say, we don't like Jennifer and we don't want her to play in our sandbox anymore.
Carnahan declined to resign during a crowded December meeting, reiterating Tuesday that she was duly elected to her position. Council members have openly questioned her conduct in handling an interaction with a member of the public. Carnahan reportedly attempted to press assault charges twice on the woman after an interaction during the city's holiday lighting event in November, with prosecutors declining to go forward with the case. Carnahan also said she would continue to attend all strategic committee meetings as her schedule allowed, prompting some discussion on the state's open meeting laws. The law states anytime more than two elected officials from the same governing body are present at an event or meeting, the public must be notified in a timely manner with an idea of what will or won't be discussed. Larissa Donovan, KAXE News.
Minnesotans are being encouraged to stay home from work, school, and refrain from shopping to protest federal immigration agents in Minnesota. The general strike is supported by unions, progressive faith leaders, and community activists. Hundreds of businesses are planning to close in the Twin Cities and across the state for ICE Out of Minnesota Day of Truth and Freedom. Community radio station WTIP reports a number of businesses in and near Grand Marais will close. Lady Sippers, non-alcoholic bottle shop in Deer River, also announced on social media it would close in solidarity. That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from BritBox, dedicated to offering viewers the opportunity to see it differently with British TV. Streaming original series, Jane Austen dramas, Agatha Christie mysteries, and more at BritBox.com. And from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. The death of a Cuban man in a massive immigration detention camp has been ruled a homicide by the El Paso, Texas medical examiner. Three people have died in custody in the last 2 months at the tent facility. It's located at Fort Bliss Army Base, but run by a private contractor. Angela Cocherga with member station KTEP joins us with more. Hi.
Hi, Juana.
Hi. So, Angela, give us just some of the details from the autopsy report.
Well, the autopsy shows 55-year-old Geraldo Lunas Campos died of asphyxia due to neck and torso compression. The medical examiner cited reports that said witnesses saw Lunas Campos become unresponsive while he was being restrained. And the autopsy also noted his medical history includes a bipolar disorder and anxiety, and a toxicology report shows the presence of medication used for treatment.
And what has ICE said about this death, as well as that medical examiner's report?
Well, the Department of Homeland Security, which oversees ICE, did not comment on the homicide ruling in an emailed response to questions today. ICE originally said Lunas Campos died while in medical distress, but did not provide details and said the death was under investigation. Now, later, DHS issued a statement that said Lunas Campos tried to take his own life and, quote, violently resisted security staff when they intervened to save him, adding during a struggle, he stopped breathing and lost consciousness. And DHS also included information about his criminal record in the email, and so did ICE when they reported the death originally.
And what has the reaction been to the declaration that this was a homicide?
Well, human rights organizations have been in contact with people inside the detention camp, and they've been sounding the alarm for months about conditions, including alleged medical neglect, lack of enough food, and physical abuse. Charlotte Weiss is a staff attorney with the Texas Civil Rights Project who regularly visits people detained at the camp in El Paso.
The medical examiner's report that Geraldo's death was a homicide completely dispels the government's claim that this was a suicide. For months, the Texas Civil Rights Project and partners have reported and documented Fort Bliss's excessive use of force.
Now, the facility is at Fort Bliss, but it's run by a private contractor. It opened last August and has a capacity for up to 5,000 people. The deaths have led to more calls to shut down the place. Jenna Garcia was among those who turned out for a recent vigil for immigrants who've died in custody.
I have just been so angry to see what they're doing, that they picked El Paso is to build the largest detention center in the country. It's going to get bigger. More and more people are going to suffer and die, unfortunately.
ICE does have plans to expand detention space in El Paso and elsewhere across the country by building new facilities to carry out the Trump administration's mass deportation effort.
And last thing, Angela, what is next as far as an investigation into the deaths of people detained at the detention camp?
Well, ICE says Lunas Campos and another man's death at the tent facility last week, described as, quote, a presumed suicide, are both under investigation. There was a third case that involved a man who died in December in a hospital where he was treated for a medical condition. That's not under investigation. DHS, in a statement today, said, quote, ICE takes seriously the health and safety of all those detained in our custody and that this is still an active investigation and more details are forthcoming. Now, the federal government is trying to deport two detainees quoted in media reports, media stories, saying they witnessed Lunas Campos in an altercation with staff when he died. And lawyers for those men, one is from El Salvador, the other from Cuba, will be in federal court next week trying to extend an injunction to keep them in the country until they can give depositions.
Angela Cocherga with member station KTEP. Thanks.
Thank you.
This month, a trove of literary classics, films, cartoons, music, and visual art, all from 1930, entered the public domain. This means that people can use these materials without copyright restrictions. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports on an annual competition that invites filmmakers from around the world to breathe new life into these often long-forgotten artworks.
One of the most unusual of the treasures to enter the public domain this month is King of Jazz. The experimental musical film from 1930 centers on one of the most influential band leaders of the era, Paul Whiteman, a.k.a. the King of Jazz.
Hello, Charlie.
Hello, Paul. Where's the band?
The portly, mustachioed Whiteman opens a small bag and winks at the camera.
I have them right in here.
Miniature musicians file out of the bag one after another like a colony of ants. A new video, based on clips from King of Jazz, is the winner of this year's Public Domain Film Remix Contest. Titled Rhapsody Reimagined, the roughly two-minute artwork captures the original film's surreal quality. Cookie-cutter rows of musicians, showgirls, and random pieces of furniture cascade across the screen as Whiteman's winking face looks on. Seattle-based filmmaker Andrea Hale created the piece.
I just wanted to sort of transform the figures and bodies into more dreamlike shapes through collage and looping and repetition.
Hale says it's a thrill for video artists to discover what's new in public domain land at the start of each year.
We're always looking for things to draw from, and just opening that up to a bigger spread of material is, of course, amazing.
These materials from 1930 have often just been in film canisters for decades.
This is Brewster Kahle. He's the founder of the Internet Archive, which organizes the competition. The nonprofit San Francisco-based library provides public access to a massive repository of digital content, including many of the materials used by contest participants. This year's entries comprise everything from a reworking of the 1930 film The Blue Angel, only with Betty Boop replacing Marlene Dietrich, to an AI-generated take on the 1930 Nancy Drew book, The Mystery at Lilac Inn.
I am inheriting diamonds in a week. That's wonderful.
Kahle says the Internet Archive received nearly 280 entries this time around, the highest number since the competition launched 6 years ago.
Things are not just musty old archival documentation of the past. People are bringing them to life in new and different ways without fear of being sued.
Lawsuits are a growing concern for artists and copyright holders alike. In recent years, there have been a surge in online video takedowns and copyright infringement disputes, especially with the rise of generative AI. Entertainment corporations are trying to address the problem by cutting deals with tech companies, such as Disney and OpenAI's plan to introduce a service allowing users to create short videos based on copyrighted characters like Cinderella and Darth Vader. Jennifer Jenkins is the director of the Center for the Study of Public Domain at Duke Law School. She says unlike such tightly controlled environments, the public domain provides a truly open playground for creativity.
This material is just simply free for anyone without a team of lawyers, without a licensing agreement, to just put online.
Jenkins also points out an interesting twist for people who create new works using materials from the public domain.
You actually get a copyright in your remakes, just like Disney has copyrights in, you know, all of its remakes of wonderful public domain works like Snow White or Cinderella.
Of course, this only applies to works created by human beings. US copyright law currently does not recognize those authored by AI. Public Domain Film Remix Contest winner Andrea Hale says in keeping with the spirit of the public domain, she's going with a Creative Commons license. This means the filmmaker retains the copyright to Rhapsody Reimagined, but grants permissions allowing other people to freely use, share, and build upon her video. Chloe Veltman, NPR News, San Francisco.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Each week, a well-known guest draws a card from NPR's wildcard deck and answers a big question about their life. For more than four decades, Weird Al Yankovic has been a hero to weirdos everywhere. And his favorite part of his job is going on tour and getting to meet those fans.
When I took on the name Weird Al, that was sort of an empowering thing. And a lot of kids have also come up to me and said how important it was to be represented in that way. And because, you know, in school, they might be considered a freak or a dork or a weirdo or somebody who just didn't fit in. And to have somebody like me to look up to basically saying it's okay to be that way, that's meant a lot to some people.
Weird Al talked with Wildcard host Rachel Martin last year about one of his non-musical pursuits, being a dad.
What period of your life do you often daydream about?
I would say my daughter's childhood. She's 22 now. She's just about to graduate from college. And I have to be careful talking about this because old pictures come up on your phone or your desktop and you go, oh, remember when you were 8? Remember when you were 5? And you go, yeah, Dad, I remember. I mean, we still love you now. We love you now.
I know. But that person's gone.
Yeah.
And you dumped her. Yeah.
My wife and I talk about this all the time. It would be great. My daughter's name is Nina. And we always used to say, it would be great if we had a Nina at every age living in our house. Just 1 through 22. 22 Ninas. Because each one is so special and so beautiful and lovely. And something just unique about every age. And it's such a sense of loss when that person becomes something else. Equally good, but you're missing the other person. You know what I mean?
I do. I know exactly what you mean. I have two kids, two boys who are 10 and 12. Mm-hmm. And same thing, except my time horizon for the nostalgia is much shorter than yours because they're younger. And also being the parent of very young children, I found to be very difficult. I love mm-hmm. them so much. They were so, so cute, but I was so, so tired all the time. So yes. I like to look at a picture that just of their cute little cherubic faces, and then I don't remember all the sleep deprivation.
Yes.
So the algorithm
just
works
the good stuff.
And that it feeds me the good stuff. Right, yeah. Exactly. But no, I completely... Completely, I know when you sit and you daydream about that, all those moments, and you're like, this is now a different person I get to know. And it just keeps going.
Yeah.
Did you always know you wanted to be a parent?
I don't know that I did, if I'm being totally honest. I hope she doesn't hear this.
Yeah.
But no, I don't know. I mean, I always thought it was a possibility, but it wasn't like I was in my 20s going, oh, I can't wait to have a kid. You know?
Yeah.
But
you have a lot going on.
But, you know, it's sort of like I've always been happy with my life. I've never been, like, lonely or felt something was missing. And I married late in life. So I went through, you know, up to my late 30s being a single man and being very happy. And then I got married and my life got exponentially better. And then I had a child and my life got even better yet. So it's all been very positive for me. And I certainly wouldn't have it any other way.
Weird Al will be touring this summer, and you can watch that full interview by searching for Wild Card with Rachel Martin on YouTube.
Support for Wild Card with Rachel Martin comes from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Northland Foundation, working within Northeast Minnesota, offering grants, small business supports, and programs to help people and communities, working toward a future where everyone feels they belong and can thrive. More at northlandfdn.org. And there are some weather-related closures, cancellations. Mountain Iron Buell, school activities are canceled for today, and there is no school on Friday. Bagley, Bemidji, and LaPorte schools are virtual tomorrow. And closed schools on Friday include Floodwood, Clearbrook-Gonvick, and Grand Rapids. And support for KAXE comes from Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, hosting their weekly pasta bar Wednesdays from 5 to 8 p.m. with an assortment of proteins, vegetables, and sauces to choose from. Information about the dinner menu is available at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Listen to the Season Watch Pod with host Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters. Season Watch is for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. This week, UV flashlights and woodpeckers. Tune in Saturday at 1:30 and Sunday morning at 10:30. Sac Zimbog near Meadowlands offers a closer look at winter bird species with a series of programs Saturday, January 24th and Sunday, January 25th. Learn about finches, owls, woodpeckers, and chickadees. Find more details and register at saczim.org/events. The next Bemidji Contra Dance is Saturday, January 24th at 6:30 at Lammers Town Hall in Solway. all ages and abilities may dance to live acoustic music by 4 Mile Portage. Everything will be taught, and the first hour is dedicated to young families. Free will donations are welcome. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Time now for our science news roundup from Shortwave, NPR's science podcast. I'm joined now by the show's two hosts, Regina Barber and Emily Kwong. Hey to both of you.
Hey.
Hi, Elsa.
Hi. Okay, so as always, you have brought us three science stories that caught your attention this week. Tell me what they are.
They are how penguins are adapting to climate change in Antarctica.
Aww. Answers to an old debate about how ice melts.
And how dirty diapers train parents in the art of disgust.
Huh. Okay.
Lucky me.
I want to start with these Antarctic penguins. Tell us what's up with these guys.
So a new study in the Journal of Animal Ecology found that they're breeding earlier than ever in the Antarctic spring. Adelie and chinstrap penguins are breeding an average of 10 days earlier. And Gentoo penguins almost 2 weeks earlier. Over the decade, the researchers observed them.
And while 2 weeks may not seem like a lot of time, researchers say it's actually a radical shift in the penguins' breeding season.
Wait, so what's causing the shift?
So penguins time their breeding period to environmental conditions, like temperature outside, or whether there's ice on the ground, or what food is available. And with climate change, the Antarctic Peninsula is one of the fastest warming areas of the world, and that could be a driver.
Interesting. So how did they collect all of this data? Like... 10 years feels like a very long time to be in Antarctica.
Yeah. So one of the study's authors, Tom Hart, says they set up 77 cameras across 37 penguin colonies, and each camera took photos every hour for a decade.
Surveillance system.
Yeah.
Yes, it was very clever methodology. We spoke to another penguin researcher who wasn't involved in the paper, Bill Fraser, and he said this camera method is a great way to get long-term data in Antarctica because a lot of work in this region is restricted to human observations.
Huh. Okay, so then what does all of this mean for the future of Antarctic penguins, you think?
Well, Tom says that's something they're trying to figure out for future work. Some penguins might thrive. For example, the Gentoo penguins are suited for warmer climates and eat a wider variety of fish. So it seems that Gentoos are doing better than the other species, which could struggle with warmer temperatures.
Okay, going from Antarctic penguins to the Winter Olympics, which are
Woo-hoo!
Just a few weeks away.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think, like, this would be a great time, then, to talk about ice science. Tell us, Emily, what is new about ice?
Well, since Victorian times, there's been this idea that ice has a thin layer of water on top, which makes it slippery, and physicists have been arguing about it ever since. Is there a thin film of water, even at temps below 0 degrees Celsius? And, like, how thick is this layer of water? Mm.
And there might be an answer now, published in the Journal of Chemical Physics this week. Luis Gonzalez McDowell, a chemist at Complutense University of Madrid, looked at research all the way back to the 1930s to address this debate. He also ran computer simulations to see how ice freezes or melts, really looking at what happens to that surface.
Hmm. And what did he find? Like, is that thin film of water there?
Drumroll. There is a very, very thin layer of water on the ice, even though the ice itself is frozen. And this is true down to negative 10 degrees Celsius. That layer of water is about a nanometer thick. And to put that in perspective, a sheet of paper is 100,000 times thicker than that layer of water.
Wow.
Here's Luis.
The surface of ice, which is solid, is always lubricated. You have always... before you start sliding, already a lubrication layer.
And this is interesting because some past theories thought that maybe the pressure from, like, let's say an ice skate, maybe the thing creating that layer of water on the ice, and he says it's always there, down to negative 10 degrees Celsius.
Okay, so then to apply this to the Winter Olympics, say, what does this mean for winter sports like ice skating or hockey?
Yeah, well, ice skates, they put pressure on the ice. And when that happens, the water layer actually gets thicker because the friction of the skate blades causes more melting.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And Luis's computer models also took into account humidity and found that humidity levels can also affect the formation and thickness of that water layer. Looking ahead to the Winter Olympics in Italy, there's already been some concern about the ice rinks and whether the ice is smooth enough to skate on. And according to Luis's work, if the humidity isn't quite right, that could also affect the slipperiness.
Hmm. Okay, going from the pristineness of ice surfaces to dirty diapers.
What a pivot. Yes.
I am so glad to be child-free. What do we got here on this front? Dirty diapers, talk to me.
Yes, this is inspired by the psychology of disgust. So disgust is really important to our survival as humans because it helps us avoid all kinds of substances that would otherwise make us, like, sick. Remember, disgust was one of the five basic emotions in that movie Inside Out?
Yeah.
Caution, there is a dangerous smell, people. Yucky! I just saved our lives. Ooh. Yeah, you're welcome.
One of my favorites.
I love disgust. She's an icon. However, there are some kinds of disgusting things that people can get used to, like the contents of their kids' diapers.
No.
Scientists call this habituation. When you're repeatedly exposed to something, you're less sensitive to it.
Especially if you're a parent, which I am. And scientists at the University of Bristol and Whitman College wanted to know, how long do parents hold on to their tolerance for these gross things?
Okay, I can't help but feel a parallel to owning a dog because the amount of times I have gotten stuff on my hands, like I just don't even care anymore, you know?
Yeah.
So I am curious.
Do it for love.
Yeah, exactly. But if I were a human parent, I mean a parent of a human, like even after my kids have grown up, would I retain the superpower, this resistance to disgust?
Yeah. So to study that very question, the research team recruited 99 parents and 50 non-parents. And they showed them two photos at once on a computer screen. On one side, a photo of something neutral, like a stack of towels or a clean sink. And on the other side, photos of gross things like vomit on a sidewalk and, of course, dirty diapers.
They're all produced by my children, by the way. So big shout out to my kids.
Aw.
This is the study's lead author, Edwin Dahlmeier, who published these results in the Scandinavian Journal of Psychology.
By tracking the volunteers' attention as they, like, looked at these photos, his team found out that the non-parents tend to avoid the disgusting photos, whereas the parents showed little to no avoidance. They would look at those pictures of soiled diapers with little aversion, including parents who hadn't changed a dirty diaper in decades, which is, like, similar to me. I am not bothered.
Oh, wow. So you're like habituated for life once you have a child?
Maybe.
This superpower does seem to last a while, according to this work.
I mean, if I had to pick my superpower, this is probably not the one I would pick. But big picture, why does this work matter? What would you say?
Yeah, I mean, disgust habituation is actually a good thing in all kinds of jobs. Think about nurses or surgeons or custodians. Edwin would love to see his work be used in those professions.
Even if we can reassure people, hey, it feels a bit gross now, but you'll get used to it over time. Hopefully that ultimately either helps or can lead to things that do help.
This is fascinating. I wonder if it applies to people who are annoying. You just get used to them over time and they stop bothering you. Thank you to
yes.
both of you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Scientist Elsa.
That is Emily Kwong and Regina Barber from NPR's science podcast, Shortwave, which you can follow on the NPR app or wherever you get your podcasts. So great to have you guys.
Thank you so much.
It's great to be here.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. This is NPR.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. Looking at weather tonight, partly cloudy with a chance of flurries, lows 27 to 31 below, northwest winds 10 to 25. Tomorrow, mostly sunny and cold with daytime highs 11 to 16 below.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris.